what we're seeing is really escalated attacks on Southeast Asian American families, including the Cambodian community, right before the holidays.
Over 24 Cambodian Americans find themselves back in Cambodia against their will. This is Thursday, December 20th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, the U.S. and China have some strong words for each other in Geneva. A third Canadian is apprehended in China, drawing what some are saying is a questionable reaction from the Canadian leader. And the Chinese liked a particular dog, so they made more of them. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Tuesday, some 35 to 40 Cambodian American community members who were living in the United States were deported to Cambodia. We want to find out more about this story, so we welcome to VOA Quinh Dinh, Executive Director of the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center here in Washington, D.C. Quinh, what's going on here?
Yeah, Ira, this is a really painful situation where what we're seeing are a roundup of individuals who came to the U.S. as refugees who had criminal convictions because of crimes of youth, growing up here with very limited resources and support in both their families and school and communities at large. And unfortunately, although they served these sentences, our immigration policies trigger them for deportation because even though they're long-term permanent residents, they're actually not U.S. citizens. And this places them in danger of being deported. And so from what we know, we understand that 36 individuals were deported to Cambodia, and that these individuals are actually the third round of Cambodian Americans who've been deported to Cambodia this year. Earlier in the year, in the spring, there was a cohort of 42. In August, there were 30. And this year, in December, we saw 36. And so what we're seeing is really escalated attacks on Southeast Asian American families, including the Cambodian community, right before the holidays. And we also understand that compared to other countries, Cambodia has accepted the most cases of deportations compared to both Vietnam and Laos, where they've accepted close to 900 to date.
The U.S. government, ICE, to be more precise, says these are people who have criminal records. Why not, especially if the law is there, act upon this and send them away?
In our experience in working with these individuals and families, what we've seen is that they have past criminal conviction records and they have transformed their lives from these crimes of youth. We are looking at individuals who committed these crimes decades ago and have started families, have spouses, and have children who rely on them. And so this for us is really about double jeopardy, wherein they have already served their time and their sentence and have served time not just in the criminal justice system, but in their communities, and have transformed themselves to be incredible community leaders and really important people in their families and communities, and they're being torn apart. For us, that is not justice. And their identity is not as a criminal. Their identity is as a partner, as a father. And they're being dehumanized in this process of only being seen as their past mistakes that they've already grown from.
What happens to these people when they go to Cambodia? What kind of life lies ahead of them, and how are they dealing with it? And do you have an example of one or so?
In the best case scenarios, these individuals end up finding jobs that allow them to use their English skills. And in the worst case scenarios, they are marginalized again in a country that they have never known because they have never set foot on this country, being either born in the refugee camps or coming here as very young children, and live lives of marginalization once again in Cambodia.
How long has this been going on? Is this limited to this U.S. presidential administration, or did it start before that?
The deportation of Cambodians has been happening for the past 20 years. So from the records that we have seen, the first round of deportations happened in 1998. So this year actually marks the 20th year anniversary. However, we have seen very increased escalations of deportations happening under the Trump administration.
How are these people to be deported? How are they picked up? Is it just in the middle of the night walking on a street or knocking on the door? How are they notified of this, and how quickly are they taken?
The majority of the individuals we've seen have actually been picked up at routine ICE check-ins. And what they understand to be a routine ICE check-in turns into automatic detention. And their families are not made aware of this at all. That's the pattern that we've seen in the last 2 years that have escalated under the Trump administration.
Quinn Din is the executive director of the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center here in Washington. Quinn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ira.
A spokesman for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, told VOA that last Monday, a flight departed El Paso, Texas, carrying 36 Cambodian nationals, of whom 34 were criminals, to their home country of Cambodia in accordance with their final orders of removal. The spokesman said removals to Cambodia increased 279% from fiscal year 2017 to fiscal year 2018. However, they said there are still nearly 1,900 Cambodian nationals present in the United States with a final order of removal, of whom almost 1,400 are convicted criminals, many convicted of the most heinous possible crimes. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Acting Executive Director Natalie Asher said, this is a quote, "We'll continue these efforts to carry out lawfully issued final orders of removal, prioritizing, as always, the removal of threats to public safety." These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman says the United States should rethink its recent rhetoric on China-Africa cooperation. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton last week criticized China for expanding its influence in Africa. U.S. envoys say U.S. officials will seek to help expedite humanitarian aid to North Korea as Washington and Pyongyang struggle to find a breakthrough in their stalled talks aimed at ending North Korea's nuclear program. Dozens of armed guards stand outside a camp in the Xinjiang region of China, many of whom were Muslims or detained and forced into political indoctrination. The Associated Press says this one operates as a clothing factory exporting textiles to Badger Sportswear in the U.S. This is VOA Asia. The United States and China are blaming each other for the crisis in the world trading system. The heated exchanges between the two superpowers took place during a two-day trade policy review of the U.S. of the United States at the World Trade Organization. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WTO headquarters in Geneva.
The Chinese representative to the WTO, Hu Jingji, said the United States is at the epicenter of the trading crisis. He accused the United States of deforming the rules of world trade, which is having a detrimental impact on the economy and on American workers as well. U.S. Ambassador to the WTO, Dennis Hsieh, retorted the crisis was caused by China's trade-distorting practices. He disputed the charge the United States is the center of the crisis. On the contrary, he said, the United States is the epicenter of the solution. WTO Trade Policy Review Division Director Willie Alfaro described the two-day acrimonious debate as lively and engaged. He told VOA, member states expressed a number of concerns. He said they were mainly worried about a shift of focus in the U.S. trade policy, which was based on five pillars.
The first one is the adoption of trade policy supporting the national security. The second one is building a stronger U.S. economy, fine. Negotiating better trade deals, vigorous enforcement of domestic trade laws and rights under existing trade agreements, and finally, reforming the multilateral trade system.
Alfaro said the U.S. has received a lot of support from member countries on the need to reform the multilateral trading system and to make it more transparent. WTO officials said members also raised concerns in regard to the introduction of new Buy America provisions, which may result in unnecessary trade barriers and increased protectionism. They also criticized U.S. agricultural policy, particularly the limited market access for certain commodities, high tariffs, and the continued use of trade-distorting support. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, China's central bank Wednesday rolled out a targeted policy tool to spur lending to small and private firms, the latest step to support the slowing economy amid a trade dispute with the United States. China's economic growth slowed to 6.5% in the third quarter. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. The Canadian government said Wednesday that the third Canadian has been detained in China, but Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the latest case does not seem to fit the pattern of the previous two. The first two cases appear to be in retaliation for the arrest of a top Chinese tech executive in Canada, on behalf of the United States. Global Affairs Canada said it is aware of a third Canadian citizen detained in China, and consular officials are providing assistance to the family. Trudeau said at a year-end news conference Wednesday there are tens of thousands of Canadians that live, travel, and work in China. He added that the new cast doesn't seem to fit the pattern of facts on the previous two. He said officials are working to confirm more details. Asked at what point he will escalate his concerns to China's president, Trudeau said political posturing or statements are not necessarily going to work to the benefit of those detained.
As I've said, over the past 3 years, we have understood that engaging in a range of different ways on different consular cases is a better way than trying to apply a one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter approach. And in many cases, escalation or very strong political statements can actually end up being counterproductive to the goal, which is to get Canadians freed, to get Canadians back home to safety. I think Canadians understand that even though political posturing might be satisfactory in the short term to make yourself feel like you're stomping on the table and doing something significant, it may not directly contribute to the outcome we all want, which is for these Canadians to come home safely. And sometimes escalation is not the right political path. Or right to substantive path to getting Canadians out of difficult situations that they find themselves in.
Meng Wanzhao, the chief financial officer of Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei, was arrested in Canada on December 1st at the request of the United States, which wants her extradited to face charges that she and her company misled banks about the company's business dealings in Iran. The Chinese then secretly detained two Canadians on December 10th on vague suspicions of engaging in activities that endanger the national security of China. Beijing did not allow Canadian officials to see Michael Kovrig, a former diplomat in China, for 4 days, and Canadian entrepreneur Michael Spavor for 6 days. Meng is out on bail in Canada. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The Trump administration's special envoy for North Korea said Wednesday that Washington is reviewing easing its travel restrictions to North Korea, that to facilitate humanitarian shipments as part of efforts to resolve an impasse in nuclear diplomacy. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. The U.S. has had its share of famous on-screen dogs, from Lassie to Benji. Well, in China, the big screen star is a lovable mutt named Juice. But Juice is getting on in years, so what's a movie company to do? Turn a cutting-edge biotech. Turn to it, of course. VOA's Kevin Enix has more.
This lovable mutt named Juice is perhaps at the peak of his screen power. Adopted off the street, Juice's unbearable cuteness made him a star. But at 9 years, he's getting a bit gray around the edges.
Juice has acted in a lot of film and television productions. He has a lot of fans. So he's a piece of intellectual property with social influence. So we want to keep his appearance going forward.
To do that, Beijing-based Synergene cloned the dog. The new baby Juice was born in September, and it's the newest example of how Beijing's biotech is booming.
First off, the future market for cloning in China is very big, mainly because we've discovered that more and more pet owners desire for their pet to accompany them for an even longer period of time. Gene editing technology will take off very quickly for us in the future, but at the moment, it's not developing that rapidly.
China is one of the world's leaders in the industry, and the government is investing millions in biotech companies in China and around the world.
Now, on the government side, the image of this cloning industry is very high-tech. And definitely our country is very supportive for those high-tech industry because of their high profit margin, and also potentially we'll cultivate more scientists working in the biotech industry.
But cloning cute dogs is one thing. Gene editing, while full of potential, can also be controversial. In late November, a Chinese scientist abandoned international protocols and claimed he had created genetically modified human babies. The claim is still unproven, but his announcement was met with outrage from the scientific and ethical community.
It's an appalling example of what not to do with a new technology that has incredible potential to benefit society.
Cloning your dog won't cause much outrage. It'll just cost you a lot of money, about $55,000. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Facebook has announced its third and biggest purge of military-linked accounts in Myanmar, where critics have charged that the social network did too little to block inflammatory material that fueled communal hatred and violence, particularly against the country's Muslim Rohingya minority. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. The Afghan Reconciliation Conference in Abu Dhabi fructified in tangible results that are positive for all parties concerned. That is what the state-run Emirates News Agency said in a brief announcement on Tuesday. By the way, fructified means is fruitful. Khalilzad, the special envoy for Afghan reconciliation, led the U.S. team in the meeting with officials of Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the United Arab Emirates, also in attendance. In a message via his office's official Twitter account, Khalilzad noted he held productive meetings with Afghan and international partners in Abu Dhabi to promote intra-Afghan dialogue toward ending the conflict in Afghanistan. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid, in a separate statement, said future negotiation meetings shall continue after deliberations and consultations by both sides with their respective leaderships. The talks began Monday and were supposed to last 3 days, as per earlier official announcement, but neither side explained what prompted them to abruptly end the process. Afghan government peace negotiators were also present in the vicinity, hoping to join the meeting at some stage, but the Taliban refused to sit with them. The Taliban, whose administration was ousted by U.S. forces in 2001, said last month it held the three-day talks with U.S. envoy Afghan-born diplomat Khalilzad in Qatar, where it has a political office. Khalilzad, appointed in September, has made several trips to the region, most recently to Islamabad, with the objective of reaching a roadmap agreement ahead of April's planned presidential elections in Afghanistan. Indiana University anthropology professor Nazif Sharani in Kabul said the pace of meetings since Khalilzad's appointment appears to indicate a U.S. effort to find ways to end America's longest war.
It seems President Trump has given a limited period of time of 6 months, plus, of course, the impending election. That are sort of on hold for the moment in Kabul for presidential election in April. So those two might be the critical factors.
What is the incentive for the Taliban to engage in peace talks? They seem to be doing quite well on the battlefield.
The people of Afghanistan will not let them have power by themselves to reestablish the Islamic Emirate, as they call it. That is a non-starter. I think militarily they may not be as long as the U.S. and international community are here and trying to protect the Kabul regime. So those two things, I think, are pretty apparent and clear to them. And the fact that they have taken the initiative to isolate the Kabul regime and be able to talk to international community, which started with the United States, now their three main allies, remember, when they were in power, who recognized them, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Emirates, are also on their side and negotiating for them. So this is, I think, something that they think they might be able to win easily rather than wait for a prolonged war. Whether this was going to actually work out is another matter. I have a feeling any agreement that may emerge through these negotiations with the three countries who have been their allies a long time ago, and the United States, who is supposedly brokering the talks, may not work in the long run because people will not accept it, especially if it is going to be the alternative of establishing an Islamic Emirate under the Taliban and not including the great majority of people of Afghanistan who have fought the Taliban and will keep fighting. And that includes, of course, the Afghan woman, as well as lots of people in the north, in the west, in the center of Afghanistan, northeast, who have been fighting the Taliban and will continue to fight them.
Nazif Sharani said the mood in Kabul is one of uncertainty, concern, and worry. This is VOA Asia. American actress and filmmaker Penny Marshall, known for the television comedy Laverne and Shirley, is fondly remembered by friends and fans. She died late Monday at the age of 75. A spokesperson for the family announced her death Tuesday, citing complications from diabetes as the cause. Slava Chahuk has the story.
Penny Marshall gained fame with the ABC television series Laverne and Shirley, in which she and Cindy Williams portrayed co-workers in a Milwaukee brewery. The comedy show ran for 8 seasons from 1976 to 1983, and fans still remember it.
Laverne and Shirley was just simply amazing. Just an amazing thing. You know, so I really appreciated her.
Everybody remembers that, you know, born in the 70s, so yeah. Good memories. She's a very comedic person, and seemed like she had a good energy.
Marshall's role as sassy Laverne DeFazio in the Happy Days series confirmed her status as a celebrity. Both shows were created by her brother, Gary Marshall. As a film director, she made her mark with movies such as A League of Their Own, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and Awakenings. Her 1988 comedy, Big, starring Tom Hanks, became the first movie directed by a woman to earn more than $100 million.
She was a great actress. She was a great human being, always giving to others. She helped a lot of women in the industry and women beyond, and just a great soul.
Marshall wrote a memoir titled My Mother Was Nuts, in which she described her difficulties growing up, which she said had forced her to develop a sense of humor. She also wrote about her marriage to fellow actor and director Rob Reiner and her relationship with singer Art Garfunkel.
I called Rob to say, hey, a picture, because he's married with 3 kids, you know. And so I said, well, you know, I'm just telling you, I wrote a book and I talk about it. Do you remember who took our wedding pictures? He said, it's 1971, how do I know? But he said, did you tell about the time we, you know, and Artie Garfunkel, you know? Because their pictures were in it, yeah. That's the only picture I had. There were 2 of us, 1 camera.
Hollywood stars and public figures took to social media on Tuesday to pay tribute to Marshall. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John M. Allison. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.